Retina Rounds, podcast number 31. Today we're joined by anterior segment surgeon Dr. Stephen Safran, who walks us through practical principles for managing complex lens cases that every retina specialist needs to understand. Let's check it out. Well, welcome everybody to the Retina Rounds podcast. Today we have a very special guest. We've been honored to learn from these very complex anterior and posterior segment cases from Dr. Steve Safran. Dr. Safran, thanks so much for joining us today. It's really an honor to learn from you today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much being here with you.
Well, for those of our viewers who aren't familiar with your path to posterior segment surgery, tell us a little bit about how, as a cornea specialist, you were able to incorporate posterior segment surgery into your surgical techniques.
Well, I was a cornea fellow at Duke back in 1991. And there were some real giants in the world of retina there. You know, Mockamer was the chairman. They had Brooks McEwen, Gene DeWan, James Tiedemann, Glenn Joffe were there. And I was doing my cornea fellowship with Mike Kobo and Gary Fowkes. And Mike had already shown an interest in using pars plana techniques in his work. And I would often get to do cases with the retina guys, combined cases, where I would suture in a lens while they did what they did, or, you know, whatever. We would combine techniques. And what I found was it was really obvious how much more control you had with a pars plana infusion line and pars plana trocars in, which you could cap and close, working in a closed system and having that control and having physiologic IOP and control of bleeding and things like that. I just found it was so much easier to do what I needed to do when I had that control working with them than with, you know, floppy open sky where you didn't have control of things. And so I just, at that point, felt it would be valuable to adopt that level of control into the kinds of cases that I was seeing more of as an anterior segment surgeon. And then I would, you know, hang out with these guys who kind of, I think they were kind of entertained by me. They thought I was annoying in a pleasant sort of way, you know, like an itch they could scratch and sort of, you know, have some fun with. So, I mean, they would actually, I would argue with them, and like they would, you know, take a cataract out with pars plana lensectomy and throw a lens on top of the anterior capsule in the sulcus. And I'd be like, why not, you know, phaco the lens, put the lens in the bag, and then do the pars plana stuff, you know, and kind of keep it separate like that, but you have the lens in the bag. And they said, well, yeah, we could try that. We could do that. You know, they were open to it. And I just thought that it was, you know, fun working with them. And they would sort of let me watch and then take over certain portions of the case and do certain things during the case, you know, and I was, I enjoyed that. So I learned from working with them and also working with the glaucoma guys. I did similar stuff with the glaucoma guys who were there. Bruce Shields was there, and it was very collegial. So I learned a lot, and even the plastics guys, John Dutton. And so then I would take what I had seen and learned, and I would scrub with the residents across the street. And they would, you know, drop a lens doing cataract surgery, and I would, you know, go back and get it. And, you know, suture lens or whatever and save the case over at the VA. And it was, you know, it was a good experience for me to get comfortable with these techniques and realize the power they had. So when I came out in 92 into private practice, I was doing, every vitrectomy I did was a pars plana vitrectomy. But we didn't have the biome, you know, the indirect visualization, the transconjunctival, disposable, you know, small gauge trocars. All that was something I had to learn in private practice. But if you came out of a retina fellowship in 92, you'd have to learn that in private practice anyway. So, I mean, I learned DMEC, I learned DSEC, I learned tubes, I learned levators, I learned a lot of these techniques in private practice, LASIK, all this stuff came out after I finished my fellowship. So I had to learn that in private practice. And I had to learn how to work with, you know, the biome and indirect visualization and transconjunctival trocars and chandelier lights, stuff like that. By the same way I learned DMEC and DSEC and those things, you know?
Yeah. So that's interesting though, that you must have spent a lot of time in the OR doing presumably combination cases, right? I mean, you had your anterior segment fellow, but you're spending a significant amount of time in the OR with the retina folks. Is that just time that you carved out on your own, or is that were this these
Both.
are planned combo cases?
Both. I mean, you know, the OR was sort of the monitors. They had a lot very, you know, this is back in 91, 92, but they had a very advanced OR with monitors. So you could watch what other people were doing. And, you know, I used to walk in and watch Gene Dewan operate or McEwen, and they didn't mind. I could scrub in and watch them. And, you know, we would do cases sometimes together. Well, I would do a case with the retina fellow where he would, you know, say, oh, you want to do this and I'll do that. We would sort of swap roles a little bit because we all liked, you know, learning from each other. It was just that was the atmosphere, and I just thought it was fun. And you know, not everybody was hardwired into their subspecialty. They were interested in cross-pollinating a bit, and there wasn't much real territoriality. There was just sort of we were all kind of learning from each other, I guess. So I enjoyed that. I thought it was great. I was starstruck, to be honest with you, to have like Blue Shields in one room and to have Brooks McEwen in another room. And then what happened was, in the middle of my fellowship year, which was January 17th, actually was the day my mentor, the cornea guy, Mike Kobo, he dropped out. He had to stop practicing completely. He had health reasons, which were kind of well known, as most people know about it. He had to drop out. So I basically, in the middle of my fellowship year, became like an attending, and I ended up doing a lot of the complex cataract cases, you know, anterior segment cases, as an attending rather than as a fellow. And again, I ended up staffing cases across the street and working with the retina guys, and you know, it was a growth process. And then all of a sudden I was in solo private practice, you know, in this neck of the woods in New Jersey. I actually started in Trenton. And it was I to the best of my ability, I was using the stuff that I had learned as a fellow. And I mean, I was picking lenses up off the retina and stuff. There's a video journal of ophthalmology doing pars plana lensectomy. From I think I sent it to you, you know, to take a look at. That's 32 years ago I did that case. So, you know, this was something that I just kept growing with. And I just felt it was a better way to do a vitrectomy, to and I've done all of my vitrectomies this way and tried to advance the techniques as I've learned by doing them and talking to people and listening to them. So I have a lot of friends who are retina specialists, and I talk to them, and I listen to them, and they talk to me, and we refer cases to each other, and we help each other. It's not really, you know, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. It's more, well, if you're going to do it, this is the right way to do it,
Right.
you know.
That's really important, I think, to have that level of collegiality and a desire to help, you know, between colleagues to help each other get better, and to really to ultimately to deliver the best outcomes for patients. That's what we're all here to do. I kind of wanted to dive a little bit deeper into this process of learning new skill sets through a career. Obviously, how we are doing things now, that a lot of our viewers are in training or maybe freshly out of training, and the way that we do posterior segment surgery now is certainly not going to be the same way we do it even 5, 10 or more years down the road. And so I guess you know, one of the fears of adopting new techniques is, you know, we don't want to do any harm, right? We don't want to try something new and then potentially cause harm to a patient. But by the same token, if we're not providing them with the best options, if there are newer techniques that are available, we're really not giving them the best possible outcome. So I guess my question to you is, how do you know when a new technique comes around, is becoming popularized, but how do you actually go about incorporating a new technique into your practice? Do you practice it in the lab? Are you watching a lot of videos? Are you talking to people? Maybe a combination thereof. How do you approach it?
Well, first of all, I'm a believer in having fastball techniques that work for you and developing them and relying on them and having faith in them and using those techniques. I'm not really an adopter of new techniques unless my back is to the wall and I feel like this is something I have to do. I feel like what we have isn't good enough. So I'm going to need to do something different or new to help this patient with their particular problem. So if I have a patient, I think Yamani is going to be the best way to go, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of them. That's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to play, I'm not going to play games and try to say, oh, this would be great if I could pull this off. That patient is there for me to help them. I'm going to throw my fastball and try to hit home, get something done that's going to help them. So always I'm trying to do what I think is best for the patient. I never try new techniques for the sake of trying new techniques. I try new techniques when I feel that that's the technique that's going to work best for this patient. And it may be a new technique for me. It may be a new technique, period. But it's something that I think, okay, this is what I think is likely to be what's going to be best for this patient. And what I'm doing is building on my previous skill set, my understanding. I mean, there's some techniques I just won't do. I just throw them out. I say, that's stupid. It makes no sense. Like I never did femtosecond cataract surgery because it made no sense to me. It just, why would I use a laser to make a Lexus? I can do that any size or shape I want. Why would I use a perforated Lexus made by a laser? It just complicates things. Why would I use incisions made by a laser? And I know a blade does a better job. So I mean, some of these things just don't make sense. Or using Aura, why would I throw out my pre-op calculations for the lens from LensStar on a pristine cornea to do an intraoperative auto refraction with the patient lying flat on their back? It makes no sense. Just so I don't adopt those things if they don't pass the smell test. But when I'm, like for example, I was referred a one-eyed patient. The other eye, she was it was lost because of a retina detachment that couldn't be fixed. And this eye is 36 millimeters. And she has a dislocated silicone lens that's all pitted, and it's sitting in her visual axis, bobbing around, but when she lies flat, it swings out of the way. And I initially said I would leave it alone. I wouldn't do anything because your risk is too high. And I spoke to some of my retina colleagues, and they're like, "Yeah, I would. The risk is very high. We don't know the risk. It's too high. 36 millimeters. She has a minus 10 lens in there. It's a minus 10 silicone lens." And so I said, "Look, I mean, I could easily do, Yamani, take that out. I could put a minus 10 AR40. It's a little bit bigger, 13.5 millimeters. Do Yamani, but your risk is just off the charts." We don't know what the risk is. It could be 10% of, losing vision. We don't know. So the guy who referred it to me, he was a retina guy actually from a few hours away, called me back like a week ago and says, "Steve, is going to kill herself if you don't fix this. She's that miserable. She's only 67. She's like suicidal, miserable. She wants you to fix it." And I'm like, "Oh, all right, so let her come back and I'll take another look at her." So I was talking to a retina colleague, a friend of mine last night. I don't know, he's Shailesh Kaushal down in Florida. And we're just talking about it. He says, "Well, your instruments, because I know that you go into an eye like this where the lens is dangling, swinging back. By the time I put my trocars in, the lens is probably going to just fall back onto the retina. It's hanging by like three zonules." So we're talking about, well, maybe if I use an extrusion cannula, because the vitrectomy instruments might not reach back to get the lens on the retina, the eye's too long. But maybe I could reach back there with an extrusion cannula, which is a little bit longer, in which case I could use a chandelier light. And the other option would be to use perfluorocarbon and, float the lens to the side and then grab it. And I haven't used, that's not something that's really in my wheelhouse. Are we talking about all the techniques we're using perfluorocarbon if I can't reach it? So I guess what I'm saying is that if I decide to do this case, and this happens, this will be my plan. If that happens, that will be my plan. But I'm hashing it out with the retina specialist, who's a friend of mine, before I get into that situation. So these are the things I'm thinking about. If this happens, then this. If this happens, then that. If I do the case, if I can't, say, look, don't maybe, maybe you should not do this case. So that's how I sort of prepare for these things. I talk to people and say, okay, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if that, you know? So if it happens, I've got some choices. And then my back is to the wall when it happens. I'm sort of saying, okay, this is how I'm gonna, you know, do it. This is what I've, and then I'll watch videos on YouTube, you know, of somebody using fluorocarbon or taking it out or doing an air fluid exchange or whatever. And, you know, I'm not going to use it just for the sake of using it. And I'm not going to do something I'm not comfortable with just for the sake of doing, you know, not. But if that's the only way I can get the lens, if I can't reach it with an extrusion cannula, then that's how I would approach the case.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned earlier that one of your fastballs, so to speak, is the Yamane technique. But of course, this is a technique that you had to learn after your training. And so I was wondering, kind of thinking back to that N equals one, and eventually it evolved into your sort of fastball move. How did you approach that any differently than what you've just described? I mean, obviously you're thinking about all the different contingency options in case things don't go as expected. How else do you prepare when you're doing a new technique for the first time?
Well, you know, I've been suturing lenses in for 30 years. I mean, I've been suturing, you know, with Prolene and Gore-Tex, suturing, you know, PMMA lenses and suturing silicone tying lens, you know, op things to the haptic and three-piece lenses. And then, you know, intrascleral haptic fixation came about. That was first described in 2007 or 8 by Shariath. And then, you know, Agarwal talked about the glued in lens, but it was really just, you know, flaps and grooves. And I adopted the that technique very early, you know, like 2012 or so, 2011. And really, to me, it was all about the vitrectomy, you know, all of these things, you know, it was all about the vitrectomy and working in a closed system. So if you were doing pars plana vitrectomy with pars plana infusion and doing a good cleanup behind the iris and doing a proper, you know, really good pars plana vitrectomy, I'm comfortable working behind the iris, it's a lot easier to adapt these newer techniques because it's a space that you're comfortable working in and you're working in relatively safely. So I was already suturing, you know, tying sutures to haptics and doing sutured in lenses. And then when the, you know, three-piece is flaps and grooves technique came out, I'd already done hundreds of those. And I was actually already playing around with capturing the haptics and needles before Yamane. So I would, you know, put the needle in and stuff the haptic. So I was already halfway there. And then when and I was melting flanges already. I was doing that on my own. And then when Yamane came out with his video showing you don't even have to take down conch, you don't even need a flap, I was like, wow, I'm gonna do that. But if it didn't work for me, my fallback was gonna be just to, you know, make a flap and do a groove. So I said, well, I'm gonna try this transconjunctival. Actually, my first patient was a one-eyed patient, and I did his one eye. And I just said, okay, I'm just going to do this. And because he has a dislocated lens and he was referred to me, I'm going to do a vitrectomy. I'm going to inject the lens. And instead of making a flap and a groove and taking down conch, I'm going to do the Yamane. But if it didn't work, I would have just, you know, done the standard flap and groove, glued in lens I was doing all along. And I did it and it worked fantastically well. And that was it. I mean, I never did the flap and groove again. It was always Yamane after that. And that was, I think, probably about 10 years ago, right around 2016 or 17, right when that video came out. Because as I said, I was already halfway there and it was all built on the vitrectomy techniques that I was already doing. I was already working in a closed system with control of the eye with a proper vitrectomy. So I was doing these manipulations with micro forceps and micro instruments. So it was something I was already comfortable in. I was already wading in those waters. And again, all of the things that I am doing are adaptations building on techniques I've already been doing, you know, and just going the next step. Like I was already doing tubes and I was already doing pars plana vitrectomy. So doing pars plana tubes, that's, you know, just adding a level, another level, another building block onto that foundation. So everything is like climbing a tree one branch at a time and just going up one branch higher and making sure you don't slip and fall. Because always, I don't want to have to look at a patient and say, I tried something new, it didn't work. I want to try something new because I think it's very likely to be better than the alternatives, very likely to be safer, and sometimes because it's the only option I have. Like I, it's just the only option. Like I was just referred a patient with megalophthalmos who's got a giant eye, dislocated cataracts, and I'm trying to think, what is the best option? I'm going to try something new because I think it's the best option for him, not because I think it's something. Oh, I want to put a video on YouTube. Talking to people, I'm thinking, this is probably the best option for this guy. To make a long story short, this guy's got a, 14 millimeter white to white. He's 40, 14 millimeter white to white, 5 millimeter AC depth, classic megalophthalmos, diddling iris like this, and the lens is four, 3+ NS and dislocated 1 or 2 millimeters down. His normal pupil, like when I autorefract him, his pupil is 7.4 millimeters or 7.5 millimeters, which is a magnification. He's probably about 6.5, but that's, it's, gigantic. But it looks normal because everything else is so big. So what's the best way to manage this? I mean, so I've been thinking about it, and I'm thinking now probably the best thing to do is to do anterior segment phaco. Use, capsule retractors, save the bag, and then optic capture a CZ70BD, which has a 7 millimeter optic, and suture the haptics to sclera, and just leave the interhyoid and everything else intact and not do a vitrectomy. Do you follow what I'm saying? Not because I can't do a vitrectomy, but because you do a vitrectomy and this guy's got a risk of retinal detachment. I do a vitrectomy, this guy's got, no matter who does it, this guy's got a risk of retinal detachment. So, if I did Yamani, I mean, you might be able to do it because the haptics will stretch a bit, but you got this tiny little optic floating in a sea of pupil, and he's going to have a ton of glare. So I've never done this particular technique. I've done something similar, but I'm thinking this out, and even though it's something new, I think it's probably, I mean, if you can think of something better for this guy, I'm all, I'll do it. Give me, I mean, I can't think of a better option.
Well, this I want to transition a little bit because this is a very unique case, a very challenging case. But I want to go to some more common complications. For surgeons who encounter these more common complications, what are some pearls that you can give them? And so let's just start with one of the most common, posterior capsule rupture, and vitreous is coming forward. What are some pearls that you have for young surgeons when they encounter this problem? And I hope you'll also discuss a little bit about removal of vitreous, either from an anterior or posterior pars plana approach.
Yeah, okay. The first thing I would say is, whatever you do, don't dig a deeper hole. I mean, when I get referred patients where there's been a, damage the posterior capsule, the less the surgeon has done, the better for me. If there's vitreous there and cortex there and they haven't done much, I can, okay, just send it to me and I'll clean it up and do a vitrectomy and do Yamani and or whatever optic capture lens and everything will be great. When they start to do things and they buzz the iris and they put an anterior chamber lens in and now there's, big incision and then it gets really, or even worse, they wait a while to send it, then it's even worse. They have CME, glaucoma, cornea edema, an anterior chamber lens, whatever. So my first thing would be don't do anything that somebody else, could do better. Don't feel compelled to do anything, just close up and send it off if you have somebody you're comfortable with. So that would be number one. Number two, if you want to do the right thing for the patient and never have them have more surgery, number one, always make a rexus properly sized for optic capture. Always think about that when you're making your rexus, especially if you're operating on a high myope, because If you do break the posterior capsule, you have a high myope, you can't just put the lens in the sulcus. You want to be able to optic capture the lens into an anterior capsule. That's going to prevent that lens from bobbing around and causing UGG syndrome. So that's number one, make a Rexus properly sized for optic capture. Number two, if you do pop the capsule and, let's just say there's no lens material, just some cortex there. I always think you should be doing a split vitrectomy, infusion and vitrectomy in a closed system. And I personally prefer a pars plane approach. Now, you can do a limbal approach if you want, if that's what you're comfortable with. I think you should always do what you're comfortable with. You should not be doing your first pars plane of vitrectomy in a moment of stress when you're fumbling and feeling uncomfortable. And this would be, we shouldn't try new things when, when you don't have to do it, when you're back, when you feel stressed like that. So I would say if you're comfortable with the limbal vitrectomy, do a limbal vitrectomy, separate anterior, infusion, separate, clear cornea, incision through a closed system, 23 gauge, 25 gauge, whatever you have, and clean things up, don't do any damage. And then if you feel you can optic capture a lens, you can optic capture the lens, inspect the retina, send the guy to a colleague, a retina colleague, have them look things over the next day. I would say the next step after that, if you're comfortable, would be to do anterior infusion with pars plane of vitrectomy, have a trocar, put the trocar on the pars plane of anterior infusion. You could do posterior vitrectomy, and then you can use the cutter on and off to clean up the cortex from the posterior side. I think that's much better than because you're pulling vitreous back. I think for me, I always would. The second there's vitreous loss, I put trocars in and I do a pars plane of vitrectomy, clean everything up, and then I clean the cortex up from using the vitrector with the cutter off, optic capture the lens, and then I go back and look and make sure that there's no pieces or anything that fall back. I'm not bragging when I say it's very rare that I have a unplanned vitrectomy. Most of the cases I have to do with vitrectomy are polar cataracts or patients who've had previous intravitreal injections by you guys. And the capsule has a hole in it, so it gets referred to me. And you're doing the phaco and the lens, there's a hole there and things start to go back. So, I mean, I have an inkling that this is going to happen and I'm sort of mentally prepared for it. And, the second it's clear that it's going to need to be a vitrectomy, trocars go in. But that would be the way I would approach also just, an unplanned vitrectomy where there's, tear in the capsule. Okay, I would put, trocars in. I would clean up the vitreous and then I would start stripping cortex from behind and I would optic capture the lens. And I don't really like to do sulcus lenses too much, but there are cases where I would do that. If the patient had a, smaller eye, a smaller anterior segment, the anterior capsule looked really secure. I had a, I would use a three-piece, I like three-piece silicone for that. The only lenses in the United States that we have available that have a direct in their direction for use that they are approved for sulcus placement are the CZ70BD, which requires a 7 mm incision, and the LI61AO, the three-piece silicone. And those are the best lenses if you want to put a lens in the sulcus. They play very well with the iris. You won't get iris chafing. They don't, if they rub against the iris, they don't chafe it. All the others, AR40s and Alcons, I've seen cause UGG syndrome over and over again. So I don't like to put those in the sulcus. I would rather either optic capture or if there's a radial tear, sometimes you can still put the lens in the bag. But most of the time, I'll just do Yamani because I've gotten so comfortable and so fast doing Yamani that I would rather just do that. And if there's a rim of capsule, that's great because it serves as a barrier to keep the lens away from the iris so that you don't, if you do get some reverse pupillary block, the capsule is there as sort of a barrier. So I really do like that. So for me, I'm very quick to do Yamani. If there's any question about, support, I have no concerns about doing that. I think it's great. I think those eyes do great. But I really think it's all about the vitrectomy and about the cleanup and not buzzing the iris or damaging the cornea. When you do a pars plana vitrectomy, you don't have all that flow of fluid against the cornea endothelium. So guys who are doing, anterior vitrectomies, and there's a lot of flow, the corneas look like hell the next day, and they often have a load, knocked off a lot of endothelial cells. But I do these cases with pars plana lensectomy and vitrectomy, and the corneas are crystal clear the next day because you have no flow. You close off the anterior segment with viscoelastic, it's shut down, and everything is done from behind. So the corneas look great the next day. It's much less traumatic.
I think that your point of doing a thorough pars plana vitrectomy is an important one, but of course there are surgeons who advocate for a limited pars plana vitrectomy approach. And my concern has always been that, I understand the rationale, right? As you said earlier, you're sort of by going in the pars plana, you're sort of drawing any vitreous that is coming forward back into the posterior segment. But when you are doing an incomplete vitrectomy, some of that vitreous is going to incarcerate in the sclerotomy. Even in a complete, thorough three-port pars plana vitrectomy, there's some degree of vitreous that gets incarcerated and fibrosis in that sclerotomy. And when you're doing an incomplete vitrectomy, my concern is that you are putting that patient who's already had a complication at perhaps a higher risk for posterior segment tears and potentially a retinal detachment. What's your thought process behind that? I mean, do you think that a limited pars plana approach is acceptable, or
Well, I
only
think it's
acceptable
under the
depending on?
circumstances, a limited pars plana vitrectomy is better than a anterior vitrectomy in that situation. I mean, again, I'm saying if you're not comfortable doing something that's good for the patient, don't do anything. Just shut it down and send it to somebody who can do a good job and put the lens in the right way. I mean, the worst thing you can do is a bad anterior vitrectomy or no vitrectomy and shove an anterior chamber lens in and leave vitreous all over the place. And I get plenty of these cases referred to me. There's an ACIOL, there's vitreous all over the place. The eye is a mess, it's hot. Well, there's been Yamani done with no vitrectomy. I mean, they're just waiting in vitreous. There's vitreous all over the place. There's a tilted Yamani lens I've got to take out. The cornea's got a cell count of 600 or 500. And I'm like, oh boy, this glaucoma. So the less you do, the better. But when we talk about an anterior segment surgeon, right, who pops the capsule, what is the best thing that he can do for the patient at that point other than shutting it down? If he's got an intact anterior capsule and he wants to put a trocar in and do a pars plana vitrectomy with an anterior infusion and he knows how to put the trocar in properly, I think that's better than, putting a 20 gauge, bipolar, infusion vitrectomy, shoving that in the incision and swashing it around and doing a crappy vitrectomy. So I think it's really a matter of degree, the retina guys who, pricking the lens up and, don't use viscoelastic and knock off endothelial cells and cause 6 diopters of astigmatism. Well, yeah, I mean, if that's the best they can do, but it can be done better. And it should be done better, but there are limits. So under the circumstances, what is the best that we can expect from that person? And I mean, I would like to see the game elevated on both sides. I'd like to see it so that we're all using the best techniques that we know of, and all roads lead to that Rome, so that you think, hey, these anterior segment guys, they know how to do a pretty good vitrectomy because we've taught them. And we can say to the retina guys, yeah, they know where the cornea endothelium is and how to protect it, how to make a good scleral tunnel incision, because we taught them. Because not everybody was going to want to do these cases. The average Joe who does 1,000 cataracts a year doesn't want to do Yamani and doesn't want to do these cases. He just wants to, maybe know how to do a decent vitrectomy if he pops the capsule so that, he can salvage the case and have a nice outcome. And that's fine. And I don't think that that person needs to, invest in a 700, a Zeiss 700 microscope and, light pipes and posterior visualization. I think it's perfectly reasonable for that guy to say, look, the best vitrectomy I think I can do would be to, do either a, two trocars or, one trocar and an anterior infusion, a Lewicki, do the vitrectomy, clean up, get rid of all the cortex and opt to capture the lens. And then refer to the retina guy and have him follow the patient with me. I think that's reasonable in that situation, but not to do Yamani. So if this guy says, well, I think I'm going to try doing Yamani and I think I'm going to do a limbal vitrectomy, I don't think that's right. I think that that's wrong. So it's a matter of what the situation is, what you're, what if it's elective vitrectomy or is it a, I don't think people should be doing, optical vitrectomies with, there's this thing now with the MST has with a needle, like a lance. And you go in blind and do a blind vitrectomy. Have you seen that?
I'm not.
The oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't want to disparage anyone, but they came to me. Well, what do you think of it? And I said, this is terrible. It's a you're putting anterior. It's for optical vitrectomy, for removing vitreous for optical reasons. It's an anterior infusion. It's a lanced 25 gauge vitrector, I think, and you just shove it in and. Do a blind vitrectomy and take it out, and it's an for optical vitrectomy. And I mean, I told the guys at MST, they like shut me down. I said, we should talk to me before you invested in this because it's a disastrous idea. I mean, it's so such a stupid thing. First of all, a vitrector with a lance tip, that we used to have that at Duke when I was a fellow. That a lance 25 gauge vitrector, and it was only used for biopsying the vitreous for endophthalmitis and stuff like that at the slit lamp. I mean, they had it in the clinic, take a little bit and for biopsy. Nobody would consider it a proper device for doing a real vitrectomy, But there's these videos at the ASCRS where people are using it to do Yamani and stuff like that. And I just think it's ridiculous. It's just not the way it should be done. My feeling is that if you're going to do these cases electively, Yamani and cases where there's lens fragments posteriorly, you should have the proper visualization, the proper instrumentation, the proper techniques, and proper backup. My backup is I have retina colleagues. If I do a case and there's something I don't like, I send it to them. They see the patient the next day, and I mean, I learn from their advice on what I could have done differently or could have done better. How to do endo laser if I see a hole or a tear. How to do a gas exchange fluid. How to do, all of these things. I listen and learn and watch videos on YouTube, and I try to keep upping my game.
Yeah, no, I think that a lot of really good points there. Less is more. Don't do more than you feel comfortable doing. I think also you mentioned how when if you are able to manage a complication and it involves vitreous, involves a posterior segment, get your retina colleagues involved so that they can be there to back you up and make sure that everything is kind of moving in the right direction. I think that one of the really one of the things that probably isn't discussed enough is really all of the thought process that goes into deciding on a surgical plan for a complicated eye. And you've already demonstrated to us all the other different things that you are weighing mentally when you're deciding on an optimal surgical plan. So I was wondering if you could share with us sort of some of your pearls. If you've got a patient who's got, for example, a dislocated intraocular lens, or they've got subluxated lens and a secondary lens is necessary. What are the different things that you must evaluate, you must think about preoperatively to have the best surgical plan and therefore the best postoperative outcome?
Okay, so there, I mean, typically I see patients with unhappy, lens exchanges. I do a lot, like from 5 to 10 lens exchanges a week. And the indications are dislocations, degenerations, like calcifications, glistenings, unhappy refractive outcomes, all of these things, UG syndromes, haptics in the sulcus, all this thing. And basically, when you're looking at an eye, if you want to just talk about dislocations to start,
Sure, we can
or
start there and then we can go from there.
so let's say it's a dislocation. Number one, I have what I just wrote an article for one of the throwaways. They asked me to write an article on complication management. So I said, I'm going to talk about the Goldilocks complex. Okay. And I said, oh, that's got a nice ring to it. Write about that. So the Goldilocks complex is, the Lenzbag complex that is not too dead, meaning it's, you know what a dead bag is? That's got no fibrosis, no nothing. Those come out. Okay. You can't talk to them. You can't play patty. They come out because there's nothing to work with, And on the other side of the coin is the opposite, the really fibrosed capsular bag with a lot of Summering's ring stuff. Those come out. Okay. So you want the Goldilocks bag has enough fibrosis, but not too much fibrosis and Summering's ring stuff. So I can pass sutures through it and lasso it. And I know that it's going to hold and it's not going to be a contracted, mess that's going to, cheese wire and whatever. So the other thing is it's got to be a lens that I feel is worth keeping. So they may have a nice Goldilocks bag with not too much Summering's ring, just the right amount of fibrosis, just the right amount. But if it's a lens that's been damaged from pitting, or it's got a lot of glistenings, or it's a hydrophilic acrylic, those always come out because they're going to calcify down the road. I don't like to play games with Acrios or LensTech lenses. They calcify, Rayners, all that stuff. So, if I'm in doubt and I can't ascertain, it comes out and I do Yamani. And it takes me about the same time to take a lens up off the retina, do a vitrectomy, and do Yamani as it takes for me to lasso the lens bag complex and do a vitrectomy. Because whenever I do any of these cases, I always do a three-port vitrectomy. So if the lens is dislocated and bobbing around, and I decide to lasso it, the first thing I do is put in trocars. And then I lasso and do a vitrectomy because if you don't, you're stitching vitreous to the lens bag complex and it's going to end up past and you can't, it's there, you got to clean it up. Well, so you're liberating junk, you got to clean that up. So it takes me about the same time to either to lasso, take down conge lasso, or just to take everything out, cut it, take it out, and do Yamani. Usually this is a 25 to 35 minute case either way. So what I've learned is that eyes tend to be quieter if I remove and replace. They do tend to be quieter. They tend to have less hypotony if I just take everything out and do Yamani. So that is what I typically will defer to. If I'm not 100% sure, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do, take everything out, do Yamani. That way I have a lens I like, right? I know the power. I know it's clear. I know it's not damaged. I know I've removed all the Summering's ring. And I know, I mean, I'm not bragging, but I do so much Yamani. It is, I know exactly how to sequence it and do it so that it's going to be pretty centered and pretty planar, like 100% of the time. Like I don't get much tilt or decentration. I've learned how to, just like if you did one phaco a month, you wouldn't be very good at it. You do 10 a week and you get good at it. And you do enough Yamani, you start to recognize how to handle different anatomies and be good at it. So there are less variables that I am not sure about if I just take everything out. But there are situations where you will want to keep that lens. Like one of the videos I sent you was a guy who had previous RK and he had a 20 6 or 25.5 diopter T7 Alcon toric in the bag sitting on the retina. And he had previous RK and he said, oh yeah, I was great with that lens. I was 20/20. And when I did, my LensStar measurements and calculated based on the AC depth and everything else and plugged it into Barrett, yeah, that was almost exactly the lens he needs. So, you can't do Yamani with a toric lens, and I'm not really crazy about suturing toric lenses to the wall of the eye, and I don't want to disrupt his RK incision. So in that case, I will lasso the lens bag complex, even. But if he did need the toric, I would just take everything out, do a scleral tunnel, and do Yamani. So these are the kinds of things you're thinking: is it a lens bag complex I can work with? It's not too dead. It's not too fibrosed. There's not too much Summering's ring, because Summering's ring, you want to get that out of the eye. It's inflammatory. You pierce it. You liberate that stuff. I've had cases. I learned the hard way. You start piercing the bag to lasso the bag, and the Summering's ring stuff starts bleeding out. And you start cleaning up, and you say, "God, I should have just removed all this crap." And the scrub nurse is saying, "Why didn't you just remove all that crap?" I don't know. They end up removing it anyway, And so that's my more and more I'm removing these things. But if I think it's a Goldilocks complex, a lens I really like, a lens that's not going to be easy to replace, a good bag complex to suture, then I'll go ahead and lasso it and suture it. Or if it's a dislocated CZ70BD, I'm getting referred more and more of these now. Patients had a sutured in, a PMMA lens with holes in the eyelids, and it was done with proline 10, 15 years ago, and it broke, and now it's swinging back on the retina. And, that's very easy to save that lens and to lasso it. So I have a good technique for doing that, which I could discuss if you like. I'm very efficient. So I'll go ahead and do that rather than making a big incision. And, I mean, that's a good lens for doing that with. You don't need if you lasso a lens and there's no bag there, it's going to slide off the haptic. So you need the fiber optic bag there to hold the suture on the haptic. But if you have an eyelet in the haptic, you don't need that. You can suture proximal to the eyelet. You can create a loop, pull it tight, and it'll hold.
When just thinking generally about secondary lenses, for our audience who are largely retina specialists, getting a lens that is well centered, hopefully stable, reasonable vision is success many times. But more and more, our patients are demanding better, not just good, but great refractive outcomes. And so, what are some of the pearls that you can provide for our viewers to try to optimize the refractive outcome in patients who are undergoing secondary lens implantation?
Well, number one, you have to measure the eyes. You use a lens star and you measure the K's, you measure the AC depth, not the AC, the axial length. But then if the other eye is phakic, you can use those numbers from the other eye to plug those into more formulas. So let's say the other eye is phakic and this eye has got a lens on the retina. You can take the AC depth and the values from the other eye and plug them in and look at formulas like Barrett in addition to, the third and fourth generation formulas to give you a better idea of how much astigmatism there's going to be, what power lens. What I like to do is I try to standardize what quadrants, where I'm going to put the lens. Okay, I usually will sit temporally and I'll try to put the lens, like at 5 and 11, rather than exactly at 6 and 12. I'm a little tiny bit oblique and I'm always around 2.3 millimeters posterior to the limbus and I'm always angulated the same. So there's a lot of consistency, because if you have an elliptically shaped cornea and you go 2.3 millimeters posterior from the limbus, it's going to be different if you're at 6 and 12 and 3 and 9. Do you follow what I'm saying? At 3 and 9, you're going to be a lot further back than you are at 6 and 12 because of the shape of the cornea, right? But what most people don't know is that the cornea is shaped like an ellipse this way, but the sulcus is actually shaped like an ellipse the other way. The sulcus is actually longer from 6 to 12 than it is from 3 to 9. So, I try to go a little bit oblique, standardize everything as much as possible. And I have a pretty good idea when I do that, what the effective lens position is going to be and how the lens is going to sit. So I have a pretty good idea of what a constant, what fudge factor I need to hit my targets. Usually I use a constant, like for AR40, I'm using an AR40. I'm using the same lens every time. I'm using an a constant about 119.35, same as I would use for a ZCBU, because that's about where it's going to sit. And I usually target minus a quarter, minus a half, just a little bit of myopia. because I've standardized everything, I'm usually able to hit my targets pretty well. And then I'll do LRIs if I need to, limbal relaxing incisions to help control astigmatism. And I do those at the very end of the case. And I actually control, I measure pachymetry, and I use a diamond blade set to pachymetry. And I actually control the IOP, the infusion, to change my depth. Do you follow what I'm saying? Like my standard IOP, I normally do these vitrectomies with an IOP of 25. I'll raise it if there's bleeding, whatever, but usually around 25 infusion. But I drop it to 16 when I do my LRI. So I clean all the viscoelastic out. I leave the infusion line in, set the IOP at 16, and do my limbal relaxing incisions. And that gives me better control. But, let's say it's a thicker cornea, I might raise the IOP a little bit to get a deeper cut. So there's just some little tricks, to try to get a better astigmatic correction. Because I would rather do that than suture a toric lens like an Invista. I'm not really a big fan of suturing Invistas. I would much rather do Yamani personally. So I'd rather do Yamani with an LRI to control, a diopter or two diopters of astigmatism than suture Invista personally. Or even do PRK afterwards, if they have a. So, to answer your question, standardizing everything as much as possible, working in a closed system, standardizing everything, how far back from the limbus, how where you put your, everything, as much as you can. Now, sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes you have to alter things because the sclera is thin or whatever, where there's a bleb, you have to work around that. But those are not the eyes where I'm really that concerned about, nailing minus a quarter outcome. Those are the eyes where, you just want to save the eye, and, if you have to go on a different axis or work in a different place and you don't end up exactly where you're targeted, it's okay. They'll forgive you. But, patients prefer, they were supposed to get a fancy lens. The guy broke the bag. It's lens material in the back of the eye. I have to frag clean up. Do Yamani. If I can get them plain on a minus a half, that's a big plus for the guy who referred me the case and for the patient than if they end up plus one or plus two. So number one, you have to know what you're getting. So you have to refract these patients. So like if a retina guy does Yamani and sends the patient off and never sees the results, he doesn't know what he's getting. But I see all these patients myself, I refract them and I keep track. This is what I'm getting. I need to go a little higher on my A constant. I need to do this. I need to do that. I used to do 2 millimeters back with my Yamani. I moved it back to 2.3 because I found that there was less interaction with the iris and the lens. I was a little further back and a little more physiologic. But if I have, let's say, a super high myope, I might go a little bit more posterior. And if it's a super high hyperope, I might go a little bit closer to the iris. Because, when you have a small, tiny little eye, you have a lot more haptic to work with, right? And the haptics are angulated, 5 or 7 degrees. So the more haptic that you have to work with, the more posterior the lens is going to sit. So you have to fudge for a little more myopia in a super small eye, whereas in a myope, the lens is going to be a little bit flatter. It's going to sit a little flatter. So you want to put it just a little bit further away from the iris. So I might fudge a little bit further back from the limbus. But generally, you try to standardize things as much as possible. If you do have a high myope, the effective lens position is irrelevant, right? So if I'm doing a 29 millimeter eye and I'm putting in a 6 diopter lens, it doesn't matter where it sits. You're going to get the same refractive outcome. The effective lens position is irrelevant with such a low power. And if you're using a 5.5 diopter lens or less, it's a 13.5 millimeter haptic length in the AR40. So it actually becomes easier to do because you have a little longer haptic to work with. You follow them? Yeah. Okay.
So I have colleagues who find this whole business of secondary lens implantation to be crazy. They tell me, oh, you shouldn't even bother with that. Just use an AC IOL. It's a tried and true lens. It's been around
Yeah,
forever.
that's
You
tried
get
and
great
true.
out. You get great outcomes. I know. I want to hear your thoughts on it. Is there any role for an ACI IOL? Because there will be people watching who will be thinking this, and I want to get your opinion on it.
Well, I really don't. I hate ACI wells because I hate having to deal with the eyes that have them that have problems. When I get referred a patient, they've got a lens on the retina. That's not a big deal. I go back, take it out, do your money, it's clean. Those eyes do great. The surgery takes no time. I have a great prognosis. When I get an anterior chamber lens, the iris is peaked and they have a low cell count, and they have astigmatism and posterior cornea fibrosis and glaucoma. Now you're talking about they may need a tube, they may need their conjures chewed up, they have CME. Those eyes are off the leash. You know what I mean? They're like dogs that are so far away from you, call them, they don't come back, And I really hate having to dissect those lenses out, the bleeding, the inflammation, the chewed up irises. I really hate them. So I don't like anterior chamber lenses because I think they damage eyes. I think that there are, occasional anterior chamber lenses that sit well and the patient does well with them. There are.
And that would be the argument that I think some of my colleagues would make, which is, yeah, I mean, you can take any lens, secondary lens technique you want. If it's not done properly, it's going to look terrible. It's going to lead to bad outcomes. A well-placed ACIOL, on the other hand,
But they're not
can work
well
quite
placed.
well.
Number one, they're not well placed most of the time, and they're often not well sized. I see these patients, the lens is digging into the iris or it's poking into the cornea, where they're not well sized, they're bobbing and jiggling around, they're rotating. Every now, it's like a smoker who lives to 90 or 95. You say, oh, this guy smoked every day and he lived to 95. Yeah, but it's still not good. And the problem is that you can do your money pretty much perfectly. You can control it and you can make it pretty much perfect. I mean, I do it all the time. I mean, these guys, I mean, I had a patient, I just did Imani, and a guy's the world's most famous portrait photographer. He's on 70 Time magazine covers. And he had a lens in the sulcus, was causing an Ug syndrome in the eye that he shoots with. And, nobody wanted to touch him because of who he was. And I looked like, take this out and do your money. Vitrectomy next day, he's 20/20, perfect. He was like, this is unbelievable. Because the lens is centered, it's just as good as in the bag. It is literally just as good as in the bag. And sometimes it might be even better. It can be done so that it is indistinguishable from a lens in the bag, in some ways better. So the potential to do your money really well is there. It's a matter of technique. That potential does not really exist for anterior chamber lenses. A lot of it is a matter of luck and having sizing work and having it work and having it just be one of those patients who can do well with an ACIOL. But even the patients who do well have pain when they touch their eye over the haptic, discomfort, they rub their eye. And over time, you see the cell counts drop. It's very rare to see a really quiet, perfect, happy 20/20 eye. In my experience, that has an ACIOL. I mean, you see them now and then, but it's pretty rare. And even then, sometimes I'll do Yamani on the other eye because something happened. And they're like, yeah, I thought this eye was good. This eye is much better. Let's exchange the lens in this eye. They want the other because it's better. So I don't like anterior chamber lenses because I think that what we have with Yamani is so much better. And you have such better, you have the ability to make it better, but it relies on your technique. So the guys you say, well, just do this, it's because they haven't mastered the technique of Yamani. It would be like somebody saying, you know what? Let's not bother with phaco. Let's just do extra caps. Let's just do Incra caps. Throwing an anterior chamber lens, it's fine. It's just as good. It's not. It's really not. So that would be my argument. You see these patients, they're on glaucoma drops. Obviously the lens is sitting in the angle. It's irritating the angle. It's knocking off endothelial cells. And the patient's doing fine until they're not doing fine. How many retina guys have an endothelial cell counter and
No,
no?
no. I was fortunate enough to be able to send my colleagues over to the cornea division when I was at UCLA, and so that's how I would get that. But it's true, I mean, unless you've got good relationships with your anterior segment colleagues, you're not going to have that equipment in-house, probably.
Yeah, and the problem is that the retina guys really, not only don't they have that equipment and they don't know, but the guys that they refer to them, they send it back to, don't have that equipment and don't know. A lot of anterior segment guys don't know this stuff. They don't have cell counters. I mean, they just don't realize. So, and it's funny because I see a lot of patients who have anterior chamber lenses and they didn't even need an anterior chamber lens. There was capsule there that could have been used to put a posterior chamber lens in without doing Imani. And sometimes I find myself separating that from the iris, which is tethered to it. And you have to do that because that's why the iris is shaped like it's all misshaped. So if you want to fix the iris, you have to separate it from the lens material that's behind it. And then when you do, sometimes you say, oh, I can park a lens there. There's a rim of capsule I can use. So it's unfortunate. That's why I'd say don't put anything in, refer it to somebody who knows what they're doing.
What I wanted to talk about next is pigment on secondary lenses. So tell me about what that means and what surgeons who do, where surgeons who implant secondary lenses and they're seeing pigment dusting on the lens, what they should be aware of.
Okay, so I have a nice video I can send you when this is over. We have submitted a paper demonstrating that in vitrectomized pseudophakic eyes with a lens vitrectomy, eyes vitrectomized, the lens is sutured or in the sulcus, you get reverse pupillary block. That's why you have to put PIs in. And the reason you get reverse pupillary block is because aqueous flows net backwards in these eyes. When you look at pigment particles floating around and you follow them, they actually are floating this way, backwards. You can see them going around the iris posteriorly. The aqueous is net flowing backwards. And the reason you get the pigment on the lens is because the aqueous flow is across the optic. It goes over the surface of the optic and it deposits the pigment on the lens. Early on in surgery, you're going to see this pigment, and you just have to dust it off once or twice. And typically, that's it. You're done. You don't have to do it more than that. Now, occasionally, you have these super high myopes. They've had retina detachments. They have inflammatory pigment cells, and you may need to do it more frequently or in perpetuity. That's just the nature of the beast. But that's one of the reasons why I moved my lens a little further back away. And that's also why I now put a PI, two PIs in high myopes, one at six and one at temporally, one inferiorly, one temporally, because the flow is positionally dependent. Okay. Basically, what I'm saying is that if you follow the pigment flow in these eyes, you'll see aqueous comes in at 12 o'clock and it goes out at 3, 6, and 9. So it flows like this. Out 3, 6, and 9, but the net flow is out. The net flow is posterior. There's more aqueous going from front to back in these eyes, and I can explain why that is. And that's why you get iris retraction syndrome, by the way, which I'm sure you've seen. And eyes that have had trauma and they have dislocated lenses and retinal detachments, they get iris retraction because of net posterior aqueous flow. So the PI, you have to make more than one PI, but you can dust that pigment off, and as long as there's no UGG syndrome, there's no iris chafing, there's no translumination defects in the iris, you've made a couple of PIs, and there's a nice gap between the iris and the lens, you dust it off a couple of times, and you're going to not need to dust it off after 6 months or 9 months. It just stops, it ceases to be an issue. But early on, most of my Imani, you will see that pigment to some degree. And in many of them, at least half, I will do a YAG dusting of that pigment once or twice or whatever I need to do.
Well, tell us about that technique of YAG dusting. Tell us how to
Okay,
do it.
so what you do is normally when you YAG the posterior capsule, you use disruptive energy. And the way the YAG works is, the retina guys may not know this. A lot of anterior segment guys don't know this. is that the YAG creates a little midair explosion, like a pop. And that pop is like a wave of energy, and it reflects off of the lens, and it creates a shock wave that disrupts the posterior capsule. And that's why it's so easy to pit silicone lenses, because it's soft and it absorbs it. So imagine you're trying to hammer a nail into a 2x4, and the 2x4 is sitting on a concrete, it'll go right in. But if you're on a mattress, every time you hit the nail, the mattress absorbs the energy and it bounces, and you don't get penetration. So when you try to YAG on a silicone or with silicone oil, you'll get pitting of the lens very easily because it doesn't get a shock wave that disrupts the capsule. So you want to be thinking about this shock wave. When you want to dust the lens, you want to create a very low energy, like a, just enough to see a little pop, like low energy, and focus anterior to the surface of the lens. So you get a scattering, and it will poof, it'll just poof, dust the lens off. So you're focusing, you have to resist the urge to focus behind because that's what you've been doing for thousands and thousands of eyes. Well, maybe not you, but most cataract guys. You're focusing anterior to the optic. Threshold power. You just keep going up until you get up a little something. You have to make sure the patient doesn't move forward suddenly because you'll hit the lens. And you just use enough power to get a, and you'll see it just and scatter off. And you can just remove all that pigment. And if something doesn't come off, it ain't pigment. It's in the lens, a scratch or imperfection on the lens. But you can easily, in 20 seconds, dust this stuff off, 10 seconds. So I just, it's like a nothing burger, just to do this.
Right. Look, I think that the passion that you have for complex cases, the experience, the desire to teach other people, it really comes through. If for our viewers who haven't already checked out Dr. Saffron's channel, I would highly recommend that you check it out. There's a wealth of information there. He's published widely. You can see there's a lot of content that he's created over the years. And I just want to thank you for spending the time with us and sharing your pearls of wisdom. I certainly learned a lot during our time together, and I hope our viewers did as well. So thanks so much.
I thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.